She's the face that launched 1,000 ships, the beautiful woman who starts one of ancient history's ugliest wars. Helen of Troy is the MacGuffin that starts the Iliad and the Odyssey in motion. But what truths lie hidden behind that myth? Or more precisely, are there any truths at all? And for a good bit of history, Western intellectuals considered Troy to be a lost city. Julius Caesar went looking for Troy in 48 BC, couldn't find anything, and he famously lamented, "Even the very ruins have been annihilated." You may think he said it in Latin, but actually, like other intellectual Romans of the day, he probably said it in Greek. Then, in the 1870s, an archaeologist named Heinrich Schliemann discovered, or more precisely, publicized a dig in a town called Hisarlik in Turkey, identified that as the site of the ancient Troy. There was a lot of controversy about that identification. There still is some. There are archaeologists who doubt that Schliemann's dig is, in fact, the Troy mentioned in the Iliad. Let's just say we know now that this site was a good-sized settlement. We know it was occupied by a group of people who spoke a language we call Luwic or Luwian. We know that site has layers from the before the Bronze Age into the Neolithic period up to the Classical era. And we have evidence based on those layers that this city was sacked on not one but several occasions. So when did the Trojan War start? Now, according to the Parian Chronicle, this is an engraved marble. It describes Athenian history from the Neolithic era up to the 3rd century BC. And on the Parian Chronicles, it says that the sack of Troy took place on the 5th of June, 1209 BC. There is some skepticism about the specificity of this date, to put it charitably, but this date would put the Trojan War very near the beginning of an episode I mentioned in our last episode, the Late Bronze Age Collapse. To recap that, the Late Bronze Age Collapse is a 50-year period from 1200 to 1150 BC. Several of the biggest Bronze Age civilizations fall in rapid succession. The rest of them are weakened considerably by war and famine. During this period, almost every urban center between Greece and Gaza was sacked and burned, so it's a pretty safe bet that these ruins of Troy, or as they were called in ancient times by the locals, Wilyusa, was sacked by raiders at some point, you know, and especially since those raiders were kind enough to chronicle their exploits in several poems. And that war inspired a whole corpus of legends and folk tales, myths. It left archaeological evidence, So let's take a look at that evidence and see what we can find out about Troy. And we'll start with the face that launched 1,000 ships, Helen of Sparta. When our story begins, Helen is married to Menelaus, king of Sparta. Menelaus is the brother of Agamemnon. He's the king of Mycenae. You'll probably recognize that name. There's a whole cycle about Agamemnon. Mycenae is a major trade and cultural center. It is, in fact, the city-state that gives the era its name. We call the Greeks of that time the Mycenaeans. Helen is the daughter of Tyndareus, the former king of Sparta, and Queen Leda. But there's another myth about Helen's origins. You may have heard the story where Zeus lusted after Leda. He came down to her in the form of a swan, and he had his way with her. According to some versions of that myth, not long after that happened, Leda gave birth to 2 eggs, and one hatched, and it formed a set of twins who the Greeks called the Dioscuri. We don't know much about them, which is to say, I don't know much about them, But we do know that the Dioscuri inspired the zodiac sign Gemini. In the other egg, we found either a baby Helen, that's the most common one, and in others, it's the baby Helen and baby Clytemnestra, who is the wife of Agamemnon. And this kind of deification of historical or legendary figures was pretty common in Greece. Agamemnon and Menelaus, you trace their heritage from Pelops and from Tantalus, who was a son of Zeus, although if you remember his punishment in Tartarus, he was a son of Zeus who got on his father's bad side. I think we can safely say that the stories of Helen hatching from an egg are ahistorical. But we can also note that in all of the legends, they all put Helen in a specific geographic location. Helen and Menelaus are in Sparta. So what do we find when we look at Sparta's archaeological record? Well, about 5 kilometers outside of modern-day Sparta, there is a mound in an area that was once called Therapne. The mound has long been known as the Menelaion. It is a shrine to Menelaus and Helen. It was built up in around the 8th century BC. Archaeologists there have discovered offerings which were dedicated to Helen, wife of Menelaus, from the 6th century. Several generations after this, in the 5th century BC, this shrine was further expanded. So we know there was a hero cult to Helen and Menelaus that starts around the time of the Homeric era. This would be about the time Homer is first reciting the poems that are going to get written down a couple centuries later. But we also know that there are Mycenaean artifacts around that site that date back to the 15th century BC. That's 700 years before the Menelaus and Helen shrine was produced, and it's at least 2 centuries before the LBA collapse and before the time of the Trojan War. And here's an interesting thing is you have the Mycenaean site, you have the stuff in the that starts in the 8th century, and between those strata, you have 700 years of very little activity. So what's going on here? One of the casualties of the late Bronze Age collapse was Mycenaean Greece. The Mycenaeans were newcomers to civilization. Their palatial culture had only really been around for a few centuries when the late Bronze Age collapse happened. And when it happened, that palace culture pretty much disappears. Greece returns to this kind of isolated agricultural economy. They even forget the alphabet we call Linear B. During the period the Spartans are building the Menelaion in the 8th through the 5th century, Greece has regained literacy. They're now using an alphabet which they got from the Phoenicians. The elite scribe class that could read and write Linear B had been extinct for centuries because there had been no demand for them. So the Greeks couldn't read any old historical records that remained. All they had left were the oral traditions that remained from that period. I can't help but note the way that the stories of the Trojan War got blended together to create a myth cycle, very like the collapse of Roman Britain and the English Dark Ages were transformed into the Arthurian cycle. We see in both cases a lot of earlier myths being woven in together. You see telescoping of events. You see people from different centuries talking with each other and such like. But you also find a very conscious process by which these Greeks, and you know, 1,000 years later, these Englishmen who are coming out of a period of chaos and looking back on an era of relative peace and prosperity, use those stories from the past to redefine their own place in a new world as a new people. I'm also struck by how much the stories of Queen Guinevere and Helen of Troy parallel each other. In both cases, you have women who are infamous as adulteresses, but who, despite this, are remembered sympathetically. The chroniclers are also divided in both cases as to whether the women in question eloped or were abducted. There are stories of Guinevere being abducted by Mordred. There's some of the earliest stories in the Arthurian canon. There's the abduction of Guinevere by Meliagant. And there are stories which suggest that Paris was awestruck by Helen's beauty upon first sight and ran away from Sparta with her and with some items from her dowry and took her back to Troy against her will. In any case, whether or not a Spartan princess eloped with a Wollaston prince or whether she was abducted and raped by a Wollaston prince, it would not have made an enormous difference to Menelaus, king of Sparta, or to anybody who was in an alliance with Menelaus. And this is another interesting tale from the Helen of Troy story. Because Helen was the most beautiful woman in the world, she had many suitors. There's one story even where Theseus, the legendary founder of Athens, tried to kidnap her when she was very young because she was beautiful at an extremely early age. But King Tyndareus knew that there was the potential for some really nasty civil war between squabbling suitors over Helen's hand. So he made all of the contestants who wanted to win the heart and hand of Helen swear an oath that the chosen suitor of Helen, all of the other suitors would recognize him as her rightful spouse, would not raise arms to try to take Helen, and they would come to the defense of Helen's chosen should anybody kidnap Helen or take up arms to win Helen. We have blood oaths like this today. We call them treaties. What they had was a mutual defense treaty. Tyndareus did this with the intent that he would stop a civil war. Spoiler alert, it failed. And if you look at the surviving literature about the Trojan War, a recurring theme is that nobody really wanted to go to war with Troy, but they all felt compelled to because of oaths. And while we don't have any direct archaeological evidence of a Helen of Troy or of her elopement, abduction, or anything else, it is pretty easy to see how such an incident could erupt like a shooting in Sarajevo into a region-wide conflict that none of the participants had actually wanted. So let's take a look at the guy on the other side, the person who allegedly runs off with Helen. According to the mythology, his primary name was Paris. The Iliad also gives him a second name. They call him Alexander. And Paris is the son of a Trojan king named Priam. Well, are there any historical records of people who bear these names in Anatolia, in that region, around that time? And it turns out there are, in fact, historical records of a Priam and an Alexandru in Anatolia around that time. More precisely, there are records of a rebel, the Hittite kingdom, called Priamirata. And we're going to talk about the Hittites now. We're going to go a bit over 15 minutes. This is going to be a long stretch of ancient history. Please bear with me. the Hittite kingdom was called themselves Hatti, or the Empire of Hattusa. We call them the Hittites because that's how they were recorded in the Bible. They're recorded in numerous mentions. The Hittites controlled a large chunk of Anatolia, that's Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. They also controlled territory at their height in modern-day Iraq and in the Levant as far north as Lebanon and Syria. The various rulers in western Anatolia, that's where Wilyusa lies, that's the area that borders on Greece, appear to have been vassals to the Hittite king. They were organized in a government unit the Hittites called Arzawa. We know they spoke a language that's closely related to Hittite. We call that language Luwian. There were several different dialects of Luwian. Some used Hittite cuneiform, where others used hieroglyphics. And we also know that the Luwians of Arzawa were not particularly happy with Hittite rulership. Around 1295 BC, we have a letter in cuneiform from Amenhapa Tarhunta. He's the king of the Seha River. He was a vassal to the Hittite emperor. He sends a note talking about a marauding troublemaker named Priamuradu. He'd gained control of much of Arzawa, including Wilyusa, had a lot of local support, and basically, Manapa Tarhunta is trying to make excuses for the fact that he didn't put Priamuradu down. We see later in another cuneiform that Manapa Tarhunta was in fact allied with a rebel against the Hittite emperor Uhazita, who was a king of Arzawa who'd been dethroned by the Hittites. According to the Hittite account, they had put down Uhazita, and they had magnanimously forgiven Manapa Tarhunta for his role in the rebellion. And that one really jumps out at me, because mercy wasn't in really great supply in the Bronze Age. Really, when you rebel against a king, mercy is usually in very, very short supply, and yet the Hittite Emperor found it in his heart to leave Manapa Tarhunta in charge of the Seha River, and despite the fact that he was unable to capture Priamuradu, who, like many people believe, was the son of Uzurhita's most famous general, Priamakurunta. It just feels to me like the Hittites were trying to save face because they realized they could not beat the alliance of Priamuradu, who has a lot of popular support, and his allies are the people further to the west, a group the Hittites call Ahiowans, and that's from the word Aegean, and we're pretty unanimous today. The Ahiowans were the ancient Greeks. We have another tablet. This one is dated about 15 years after the tablet Manapa Tarhunta sent. It's between the Hittite emperor Muwatalli I and a Wilyusan king named Alaksandu. And that's an interesting name. Alaksandu is obviously Greek. It's not a Luwian or a Hittite name. And Muwatalli's letter talks about the long years of friendship between Wilyusa and the Hittites and includes some subtle allusions that Alaksandu's the first king in his dynasty, or stuff like, you know, that combination of flattery and insult that courtiers and kings have always been so good at. But it's suggesting that Alaksandu had been put in place in a region where Priamuradu had gained control a bit earlier, and the Hittites are treating it like a done deal. We also know that Priamuradu married his daughter to the governor of Milawanda. That was a town in Anatolia that had been supportive of the rebels. It was a town with a large Greek population. The governor was Greek. So we see that there were strong ties between the people of Wilyusa, the Trojans, and the Greeks for a long time. They were basically allied against the Hittites. This would have been the far western end of the Hittite Empire, analogous to the way, again, that Roman Britain, Britannia, would have been the far furthest western reaches of the Roman Empire. And you know, as the Hittite Empire collapses, they're facing a lot of pressure from another group that gets mentioned a lot in the Bible, the Assyrians. So as they start losing control over that region, you see local kings rising, and you see them making alliances with their Mycenaean and their Greek neighbors, and you see them also competing with the Greeks as the Greeks begin building colonies in Asia Minor on land that is occupied by Luwian speakers. We can't say whether or not Helen of Sparta and her elopement, abduction, what have you, was the catalyst for the Trojan War, but we can say that given the conditions of that time, a war between the people of Wyllisa and the people of Mycenae was inevitable. According to the Greeks, Homer's Trojan War was actually the second Greek attack on Troy. The first happened 3 generations earlier. Heracles sacks the city and kills the ruling family after they refuse to give up white horses as a sacrifice to Poseidon in exchange for Heracles ridding the area of a sea monster which had been sent there by Poseidon. The only survivor of the royal family was a boy who had dealt honestly with the big Greek muscleman. He had been saying from the beginning that his family should give up the horses as per their agreement, and that boy was named Priam, and in exchange for his honesty, Heracles put him on the throne of Troy. Now, Priam rules for several generations, but he rules long enough to see the second attack on Troy. When he sees his line end, he's slaughtered after he sees his infant great-grandson thrown from the tower and dashed on the rocks, and he sees his city razed to the ground in the final attack. You know, I can't tell you whether Heracles attacked the city of Troy before or after he dragged Charybdis from the underworld, but I can tell you that in the Bronze Age stratum of Troy, archaeologists found 2 destruction layers. One is dated to around 1190 BC, that's 7a, that would have been around the time of the Late Bronze Age collapse. There's another layer of destruction at level 7h, and that one the archaeologists date about a century earlier. Thanks for watching Ancient History in 15 minutes, give or take a few minutes. If you enjoyed this video, don't forget to like and subscribe.